All right, welcome to another deep dive today.
Yeah, excited.
We are going all the way back to the early Republic.
Ah, early American history.
I've been really looking forward to this one.
Yeah, it's going to be fun.
You sent over some really good material.
It is a fascinating period.
This is on the Second Great Awakening, right?
That's right.
I mean, I know a bit about it, but I'm excited to get your take on it.
It's really a time of just tremendous change and upheaval in America. And, you know, when we think about the late 18th, early 19th century.
Yeah.
I mean, I think most of us, we think about the expansion westward.
Right. Lewis and Clark and, you know.
Manifest Destiny, all of that.
Yeah, exactly.
But underneath the surface of all of that,
mm-hmm.
there's this massive religious revival brewing.
So was this like a reaction to the revolution or was it something separate?
Well, it's interesting, right? Because between 1750 and 1800, the territory of the U.S. tripled.
Wow.
And the population increased fivefold.
Five times.
Yes, five times.
It's incredible.
Yeah, so you have this huge influx of people and this huge expansion of territory.
Right.
And really begs the question, you know, can the church?
Yeah, can they keep up?
Yeah, can the existing kind of religious institutions keep up?
Right.
And that's really one of the driving questions behind the Second Great Awakening.
It seems like an impossible task.
It's a massive undertaking, you know?
Yeah.
And they're trying to figure out, you know, how do we minister to all these people? How do we reach them?
So who are the key figures that we're going to look at today? What are the big differences between, you know, this awakening and, you know, previous awakenings?
Sure. So I think we can start with, you know, some of the key individuals.
Yeah, let's do it.
Who are really driving this movement.
Okay.
And one of the most significant figures is Timothy Dwight.
Timothy Dwight. Okay.
And, you know, he's not some frontier preacher.
Right.
He's actually the president of Yale University.
Wow. So this is starting in academia.
Yeah. It's an interesting place for a revival to begin.
Yeah, for sure.
And Dwight's really concerned, you know, because during this period, Yale had experienced a decline in religious emphasis.
Yeah. I mean, that makes sense with the Enlightenment and everything.
Exactly. And he's very concerned about this drift away from the spiritual foundations, mm-hmm. especially amongst the students.
Right.
And so he takes some pretty bold steps to address this.
Okay, so what does he do?
Well, as president, he really elevates religion as this central aspect of university life.
So he's making it like part of the curriculum or something?
Yeah, he's teaching extensively, obviously.
Right, yeah.
But even more significantly, I think, he starts preaching regularly.
In the chapel or?
In the Yale chapel, yeah.
Okay.
And his preaching is really powerful.
Oh, wow.
And your material indicates that, you know, his efforts there, starting around 1800,
right.
are really considered the starting point of the Second Great Awakening.
So it's interesting. It's almost like an intellectual re-engagement, and then that kind of radiates outwards.
Exactly.
And there's also a revival at Yale, right, under his leadership.
That's right, yeah.
Okay, so that's interesting. Sort of reminiscent of the First Great Awakening with, you know, Whitefield and Edwards.
Yeah, there are definitely some parallels there.
Yeah.
And Dwight's influence extends beyond just Yale, too.
Oh, so this isn't just like an academic revival. This is really going out into the world.
No, not at all.
Okay.
He mentors this whole generation of young men. Who then carry this revivalist kind of zeal out into society.
Okay.
And two figures in particular are really important.
Okay.
Lyman Beecher and Nathaniel Taylor.
Oh, yeah. Lyman Beecher.
Now, you recognize that name, and your notes connect him to
his daughter, Harriet Beecher Stowe.
Exactly.
Uncle Tom's Cabin, yeah.
There you go.
So, talk about impact, I mean.
There's a whole lineage impact there.
Yeah.
But what's interesting about Beecher is that he was a student of Dwight's at Yale.
Okay.
And he becomes this incredibly influential preacher.
So, unlike Dwight, who stayed at Yale, Beecher is actually going out.
Yeah, he's pastoring.
He's pastoring and really spreading this message.
Spreading the message, yeah, through his sermons.
Okay, and then what about Taylor? You said Nathaniel Taylor, right?
Nathaniel Taylor, and he was also at Yale during Dwight's presidency.
Okay.
He was a professor there.
So still in academia, but he was also trained by Dwight.
That's right.
And playing a part in this Yale revival.
Exactly. So you have this really interesting kind of hub in New England.
Yeah, of religious and intellectual
ferment.
Yeah.
Okay. But this wasn't just a New England thing, right?
No, not at all. And your material brings up another key figure, Alexander Campbell.
Alexander Campbell. Okay.
And Campbell's really important because he's the one who brings the Second Great Awakening to the South.
Wow. So we have two sort of epicenters
of
this awakening
I do.
In the North and in the South.
Exactly.
So tell me about Campbell. Like, what was he all about?
So Campbell's a really interesting figure.
He's a significant church leader in the South, and he goes on to found the Disciples of Christ movement.
Disciples of Christ. Okay, and now I remember, you know, you use this term restorationism. So yeah. What's that all about?
So restorationism, as it relates to Campbell and the Disciples of Christ,
okay,
it's this idea that they're trying to restore the church to its New Testament roots.
Oh, interesting. So they're trying to, like, go back to the basics.
So they see this purity, this authenticity.
Okay.
In the early church.
Yeah.
And they're trying to recreate that in the 19th century.
So it's kind of like a back to the future kind of thing.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that idea was very powerful.
Yeah, it makes sense.
In the South, especially.
Okay, so we're seeing two really distinct, you know, flavors of the Second Great Awakening.
Yeah.
Each with its own sort of approach and maybe even theological emphasis.
Exactly. And your notes also mentioned Charles Finney.
Oh, yeah, Charles Finney.
But he's a little bit later, right?
Yeah, later in the timeline.
Yeah, his revivals happen later, and there's some debate among historians
about whether Finney is a continuation of the Second Great Awakening.
Or whether it's distinct enough to be called a Third Great Awakening.
That's really interesting. I think that's something we could do a whole other deep dive on.
Absolutely.
Yeah, maybe we should save that for later.
For another time, yeah.
But before we get too far into the, you know, the regional variations.
Sure.
You mentioned some earlier figures who, you know, in a way, they kind of laid the groundwork.
They did.
For the Second Great Awakening.
They did. And these are figures like Wesley, Coke.
Okay.
And particularly Asbury.
Okay. So these are the Methodists.
Yes. And especially within early Methodism.
Okay.
You know, they played a really crucial role.
So what did Asbury do specifically that was so important?
Well, he's ordained in 1784.
Okay.
And he becomes this just tireless, itinerant preacher.
So he's traveling all over,
yeah, covering huge distances, spreading the Methodist message.
So he's really setting the stage, I guess.
He really is. He's cultivating this receptive environment for the later Second Great Awakening.
Okay, so let's get into these two different, you know, manifestations that you talked about, North versus South.
They are very different.
Really different.
Yeah. So the Northern manifestation, the one centered around Dwight and Yale,
really
reflects that New England culture, right?
Yeah. The kind of reserved intellectual.
Exactly. It's less overtly emotional.
Okay.
The focus is really on preaching in established churches.
Yeah.
And hymn singing.
So it's very kind of like measured and thoughtful.
Yeah, it's intellectually driven.
Yeah, okay.
Very theologically grounded.
Right, and that makes sense given the context, you know, these are established institutions.
Yeah.
Now, contrast that with what's happening in the South.
So the South is a whole different ballgame.
Okay.
Camp meetings.
Yeah, camp meetings, right? That was a big thing in the South.
That is the defining characteristic of the Southern Second Great Awakening.
So what were those like? Like, paint a picture for me.
Okay, so the first big one
is
at Quain Ridge, Kentucky. In 1801.
Okay.
And this is pretty novel.
In American religious history.
Yeah, it's a new thing.
Okay.
So imagine, you know, these huge gatherings, multi-day gatherings, sometimes a week, sometimes even longer.
Wow.
People are living in tents.
So it's like a religious festival almost.
It is. It's like a massive, you know, outdoor revival meeting.
So what's the atmosphere like?
Oh, it is intense.
Okay.
Very emotional. Very different from the North.
Okay.
They rely heavily on lay preachers.
Okay, so these are people who aren't necessarily...
They don't have formal theological training.
But they know their Bible.
They know their Bible. They're very charismatic.
Right.
There's lots of singing, spontaneous dancing.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And even people fainting.
Really?
Yeah. It's described as just this really overwhelming experience.
So I can see how people from the North might have looked at that.
Yeah.
And been a little bit skeptical.
Oh, absolutely. They viewed it with a lot of suspicion.
Yeah.
Like, this is uncontrolled. This is, you know, lacking theological depth.
Right.
Maybe even dangerous.
But for the people in the South, this was...
This was real. This was authentic.
This was powerful.
It was powerful, yeah, and fostered a sense of community.
Right.
A real personal connection to their faith.
Yeah, and it's interesting because these camp meetings weren't just a passing fad.
No, they continue.
They still happen.
In various forms.
Today.
Yeah, even today.
I had no idea.
Yeah, so like Old Orchard Beach in Maine.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Lake Junaluska in North Carolina.
Okay.
These are places that still have these camp meeting traditions.
That's fascinating.
And even near you, near Gordon College.
Really?
Yeah, Asbury Groves in Hamilton, Massachusetts.
Okay.
That was a major camp meeting site.
I've heard of that, yeah.
They even had a railway line built to bring people in from Boston.
No way.
Yeah, it was a huge deal.
Wow.
And it's named after Francis Asbury.
Oh, okay.
So that direct connection to those early Methodists.
Right.
And they even have the E. Stanley Jones Chapel there.
That's fascinating to think that, you know, right in our vicinity.
Yeah.
There was this.
This hub.
Yeah, this historical hub of this, you know, nationwide movement.
It's pretty amazing.
So let's talk about, you know, we've looked at the key leaders. Mm-hmm. We've looked at the different regional expressions.
Right.
What are the long-term consequences?
Yeah, what's the impact?
Of all this, you know, religious energy.
Well, it's profound.
Okay.
And it's far-reaching.
So what are the key areas that you identified?
Sure. So the first big result is that revivalism becomes more accepted.
Okay.
As part of American religious culture.
So the first Great Awakening kind of...
It laid the groundwork.
Laid the groundwork, but this really solidified it.
Yeah, this is where it really takes hold. And you see this legacy continuing through later figures.
Yeah.
Like Charles Finney, or Dwight L. Moody.
And even Billy Graham in the 20th century.
Exactly. It sets this pattern of expectation.
Right. Like, this is how you do religion in America.
Yeah, these large-scale religious gatherings become more normalized.
Okay, so that's one big result.
Yeah.
What's the second one?
So the second major result is this surge in voluntary societies.
Voluntary societies. So these are like grassroots organizations.
Exactly. Local organizations. Yeah. Often bringing together people from different denominations.
So it's like a kind of ecumenical spirit.
Yeah, you could say that.
Okay.
Working together for common goals.
So what kinds of things were these societies focused on?
Well, a lot of them were focused on missions.
Missions, okay.
Yeah, spreading the gospel.
Both domestically and abroad.
Yeah, both.
Okay.
And this is where you see organizations like the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions.
Okay, and that was founded when?
1810.
Okay, so right in the middle of this period.
Yeah, right in the thick of it.
And it's interesting to see that connection to the founding of Gordon College.
Right.
You know, as a missionary training school.
Yeah, that direct link to the Second Great Awakening.
So this impulse to spread Christianity globally,
yeah,
is a direct result of this awakening.
Absolutely.
Okay, that's fascinating.
And the third outcome, you know, your notes mentioned education.
Yeah, education.
And this has a few different facets.
Okay.
So first, you see this big push to distribute Bibles and tracts.
Okay, so trying to get the word out.
Yeah, getting scripture into people's hands.
Okay, so that makes sense.
And then secondly, you have the rise of Sunday schools.
Sunday schools. Now, those were originally for...
teaching literacy.
So people could read the Bible.
That's right. It wasn't just about religious instruction. It was about giving people the tools.
To engage with the scripture themselves.
With breaks.
Okay. And the third aspect of education...
is the founding of colleges, universities, and seminaries.
Right, for training pastors?
Pastors, leaders.
Yeah.
So this is a period of real institution building.
Okay, so you listed several key institutions that were founded during this era.
Right.
Andover Seminary, Princeton Seminary.
Yes.
Harvard Divinity School and Yale Divinity School.
And it's interesting to look at, you know, their denominational affiliations.
Yeah.
Their founding dates.
Yeah. Okay, so Andover was founded for the Congregationalists in 1808.
That's right.
Princeton for the Presbyterians in 1812.
Although Princeton University had an earlier origin.
Right, but the seminary was founded in 1812.
Exactly.
Okay. And Princeton's history is really interesting because it's so tied up with these doctrinal confessions.
Yes, the Westminster Confession and then later the 1967 Confession.
And these are, you know, these are foundational documents.
They are.
Outlining the denomination's beliefs.
Exactly, their commitments.
Yeah, it's more than just a list of doctrines.
Right, absolutely.
It's a real statement of, you know,
of
identity and how they see themselves.
Yeah, and how they live out their faith.
And how they engage with the world.
Exactly.
Okay, so that's Princeton. Now, what about Harvard Divinity School?
So Harvard Divinity School, that was founded in 1816.
Okay.
And notably, it's a Unitarian institution.
So a different theological trajectory.
Yeah, very different.
Okay, and then finally, Yale Divinity School.
Yale Divinity School in 1822.
Okay.
And that's after Dwight's, you know, initial work at the university.
Right.
But it's specifically for training congregational ministers.
Okay, so this whole wave of educational institution building,
yeah,
really had a long-term impact.
It did.
On American Christianity.
It really shaped theological scholarship.
Yeah.
The training of leaders.
Yeah, for generations to come.
Absolutely.
Okay, so moving on, the fourth result you mentioned is this emergence of all these moral and humanitarian crusades.
Yes.
Which makes sense given the Second Great Awakening's emphasis on loving God and loving your neighbor.
To that outward focus, right?
Right. So can you give me some examples?
Sure. So one of the biggest ones is the temperance movement.
Okay, temperance, that was...
advocating for total abstinence from alcohol.
Okay, so that was in response to the social ills of, you know, rapid urbanization.
Exactly. Cities were growing.
And there was a lot of...
drunkenness, violence.
Yeah, poverty, I imagine.
Yeah, and so temperance was seen as this way to...
to reform society.
To reform society, to improve people's lives.
Okay, and so what other crusades were happening at this time?
Well, there was also a peace movement.
Okay, so people are really trying to make the world a better place.
They are, yeah.
Okay.
But the big one, of course, is the anti-slavery movement.
Abolitionism.
Abolitionism, yeah.
Yeah, that really overshadowed.
It did, yeah.
Everything else.
It became the moral battle of the 19th century.
Right, and the roots of that movement can be traced directly back to...
to the Second Great Awakening.
Yeah, I mean, the moral fervor.
Exactly.
The emphasis on human dignity.
All of that.
Yeah, that's really powerful.
And it's important to remember that, you know, this fight against slavery had its origins in this time of religious revival.
Absolutely. Okay, so that's the fourth result. Now, what about the fifth one?
So the fifth result is the growth that many denominations experienced.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about, you know, the population explosion.
Right.
So it makes sense that the churches would be growing too.
Exactly. They're trying to keep up with this, you know...
westward expansion.
Westward and southward expansion.
Yeah. Can you give me an example of a specific denomination that grew a lot during this time?
Sure. So the Methodists are a great example.
Okay, the Methodists.
In 1784, around the time Asbury's ordained, there are about 15,000 Methodists in the colonies.
Okay.
And at this point, Methodism is still part of the Anglican Church.
Right, right.
It's not a separate denomination yet.
But then by 1850...
by 1850... there are over 1 million Methodists.
Wow, 1 million. That's incredible growth.
It's massive growth.
So what explains that?
Well, a couple of things. First, you know, the formal separation from the Anglican Church.
Okay.
After John Wesley dies in 1791.
Okay.
That allows American Methodism to really develop its own identity.
Right, its own structure.
Exactly.
Okay.
And then the other big thing is the appeal of those itinerant preachers.
Yeah, like Asbury.
Asbury, yeah.
Just going out and spreading the word.
Yeah, they're traveling all over.
Bringing the message directly to the people.
Directly to the people, yeah, even in remote areas.
And Wesley himself, he wasn't initially keen on a separate American denomination.
No, he was hesitant at first.
But his passing really paved the way.
It did, for that growth.
And other denominations, you know, like the Baptists, Presbyterians, Congregationalists.
They also saw...
they're all growing.
A lot of growth.
Yeah, trying to keep pace with this... expanding nation.
Okay, so the Second Great Awakening.
Yeah.
It wasn't just about individual lives.
No.
It really reshaped.
It reshaped the religious landscape.
Absolutely.
Okay, so you mentioned a sixth result.
I did.
But we're not going to get into that today.
We need a whole other deep dive.
Yeah, we need a whole other deep dive for that.
That's right.
Can you at least give us a little hint?
Sure.
About what that sixth result is?
So the sixth result is about the impact of the Second Great Awakening on American religious thought and theology.
Okay, so it's a big one.
It's a big one, yeah.
All right, we'll have to save that for another time.
Definitely.
So, to sum up today's deep dive.
Yeah.
It's clear that the Second Great Awakening was a powerful...
powerful and multifaceted...
movement, yeah.
It wasn't just one thing.
Right.
It took different forms.
From the intellectual revivals in the North...
yeah.
...to the emotional camp meetings in the South.
Exactly.
And the consequences were... huge.
Ouch.
I mean, it's hard to overstate.
It's hard to overstate it.
The impact of this awakening on American life.
And what's fascinating to me is, you know, we see these tensions between the experiential and the intellectual.
Right.
And that continues to play out.
Today.
Even today.
In religious life.
Yeah. How do we balance those things?
It's a great question.
It's a question that's still with us.
It's a question that we're still wrestling with.
Absolutely.
And, you know, for you, the listener, we encourage you to think about, you know, the leaders we talked about, the different styles of this awakening.
That impact.
The impact on education.
On social reform.
On the denominations that are still with us today.
And maybe even explore some primary sources.
Yeah, go back to those original texts.
Read some of these sermons.
Yeah, and see what speaks to you.
and see what resonates.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for joining us for this deep dive.
It was my pleasure.
And we'll see you next time.
See you then.